supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Larry Roebling. Welcome to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb.
When trying to stop terrorists from killing, what is the path to most good? You know, what is right when fighting wrong?
It was not polite to talk about having been raped, let alone to talk about having been raped and nearly murdered.
For some, trauma is one day when their lives changed forever. Others bear the recurring brunt of PTSD.
Everything changes from that point. You are in free fall for however long your constitution, your history, your trauma says. There you are, and that's the beginning of the end and the beginning of a beginning.
What is our response to trauma as individuals and as a society? Is there a connection between traumatic experiences, either a singular personal event, or multiple experiences of combat and witnessing torture? Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guest grappled with those questions at a recent live event in conjunction with the University of Pennsylvania's Law School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Joining Dr. Dan were Susan Bryson, author of Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self, and professor of philosophy at Dartmouth College. Bill Edmonds, author of God Is Not Here, Torture, Trauma, and the Moral Injuries of War. He's a lieutenant colonel in the Army Special Forces. We'll hear from our audience later in the show, but first, Bill Edmonds found that writing his memoir was one way to understand his struggle with a soldier's moral injuries. While Susan Bryson found writing a book was not only an examination of the field of philosophy, but also part of coming to terms with her violent attack.
1990, all of a sudden, everything changed for you. You were brutally raped and left for dead. You said that in the aftermath, you weren't quite sure whether you died there and that the world had moved on without you. For those who don't understand that language, what does that mean?
For some time after that assault, which was in the summer, I felt tempted to say to people who asked about it, I was murdered last summer in France. Of course, that makes no sense. But I started reading about trauma survivors, and many of them said things like, I'm not the same person I was before. Holocaust survivor Charlotte Delbo said, I died in Auschwitz, but no one knows it. It made me realize that I wasn't alone in this feeling, that in some sense, I left myself behind at the bottom of that ravine.
Did it change your relationship with your body?
It did make a difference. I was 35 at the time, and my husband and I had just about 6 months before decided, hey, wouldn't it be fun to have a baby? So we had been trying to conceive. After the assault, it was 2.5 years before we could even begin to try again. So it did change my relationship. It also felt as if my body had betrayed me. You know, I had felt empowered by my body. My body was there to do what my mind was telling it to do. And in this case, it brought me very close to death.
It wasn't your body that betrayed you. It was this person or the world or however you want to look at it, but it was neither you nor your body. Nevertheless, you were betrayed.
And actually, that wasn't the main thing that I experienced. The main thing that I experienced was this profound lack of trust in humanity and in the world. I wasn't jogging, I was just walking by myself down a country lane in southern France. And I, after about a half an hour, felt a little bit uncomfortable because I saw a young man a little bit down the road. And I'd been picking wild strawberries, and I thought, ooh, maybe I was picking his strawberries and that wasn't such a good thing. And so I said, bonjour, hello. And he said, bonjour. And next thing I knew, it was just something slammed into me from behind. And I had no idea what happened. I thought I might have been hit by a car or it. And then it was clear he grabbed me and took me to the underbrush and hit me, sexually assaulted me, and strangled me several times into unconsciousness. And ultimately, I was able to pretend to be dead And he walked away, and I waited until I couldn't hear his footsteps anymore, and I clambered up the ravine and was rescued. But I think one of the hardest things for me to recover from was that one could be walking along, say hello to a fellow member of the human community, have the person say hello back, and then a few seconds later be struggling to stay alive because he's trying to kill you.
Most, myself included, describe the experience of trauma as there you are, living your life, walking down the street, and all of a sudden there's no sidewalk and you're in free fall. And everything changes from that point. I want to take that comment and I want to turn to you, Bill, because your story's different and you weren't walking down the street.
And I'd ask that you not focus on the details because it's not about me. It's more about raising the awareness of how my experience is similar to so many other service members and veterans and their wartime experiences. And I'd also argue that you can find similarities in my experience with your own lives and your own experiences. My journey for this discussion began in 2005 in Iraq. I was assigned to live on a tiny Iraqi base in the center of Mosul, which was a jumble of religions, ethnicities, and tribes that were all seeking revenge for some long past but not forgotten wrong. Essentially, Mosul was and still is, you know, chaos, a place where evil people can finally reach their full potential. I was an interrogator. My job was to partner with one Iraqi intelligence officer and interrogator. I'll call him Sadie, which is Arabic for sir. And he'd been doing this work for over 30 years. My job was to coach, teach, and mentor him, but I was unable to give him orders. Instead, the only power I had was the power of persuasion, the ability to use my experience and try to nudge him in what I felt was the right direction, to one, help him defeat the insurgency while simultaneously, and as long as it didn't contradict that first rule, try to deter his use of torture. I immersed myself in that experience. Sadie only interrogated with one rule, which was do what's necessary, get information, then a confession, because these are killers and lives hang in the balance. My world focused down to the struggle to answer one existential question. When trying to stop terrorists from killing, what is the path to most good? You know, what is right when fighting wrong?
Were you struggling with these issues in the middle of all that?
Yeah. As the dozens of terrorists transformed into hundreds of people with faces, my trust in my own moral beliefs and my belief in the rightness of what my country sent me across the world to do was slowly eroded by moral dilemmas that I now realize I was utterly unprepared to face. You know, do I hold back the heavy hands? Do I try to protect a horribly evil person? And as a consequence, in my mind, take an innocent life later by proxy? Or do I avert my eyes? Do I choose to be complicit in a moral wrong, yet do so because I wanted to save a life? An American, an Iraqi man, but more importantly, and most likely, innocent and helpless Iraqi woman and child. Now, I now realize that the narrative that I describe was fundamentally flawed. But at the time, that's what I believed, and that's what I used to guide my decisions, my choices inside of that prison. But I now realize that what I'd done was construct essentially a moral minefield. And I'd done so without allowing myself an exit. And I had stepped in. And every step, every choice felt like dying a little death. So I returned home with no visible wounds, but, you know, I was different. Something had changed inside. Now, that's something I think is what hopefully we'll talk about, and that's what I think is very similar between Susan's experiences, though on the top, on the face of it, they're very different. I think they are very similar, and I think at its core is moral injury.
You're listening to a Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guests, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Edmonds and Professor Susan Bryson. Joining the panel now is Dr. Stephen Zanekis, a retired Brigadier General and Army Medical Corps officer who's been a senior advisor to the Department of Defense on neurobehavioral conditions.
Steve, let me invite you to pick up on this.
The experience for many soldiers and other individuals who have been the victims of very frightening events in their lives is confusion and trying to discern what are the conflicts, the tension that they feel in their souls and in their sense of consciousness of what otherwise they've considered rather distinct feelings and thoughts. And then something happens, something that's extremely frightening, shocking, and all this seems to just pile in. And it no longer makes sense in the clean way that it's made sense before. And you're left with trying to come out of it in a way that still allows you to function and not feel burdened by confusion or anxiety or worry or doubt.
When you say come out of it, you know, the dimension of that I hear is come out of it alone, without guidance, without a rule book, without a mentor.
I think many people do feel very alone, and in fact, it may be the emotion that is so common, both at that moment of when one gets frightened and one is traumatized, is the overwhelming sense of not having someone to be tethered to, someone that can reach out, someone that can share, and you have confidence that can share the experience that you've just had.
Susan?
I marvel at how Bill survived his experience because he was alone. And even 5 years later, dealing with the aftermath of that year, he was alone. I don't think I could have survived alone. And my experience led me to the view that even though one person can undo another person, in my case, it was probably in 45 minutes, with the help of other people, you can rebuild a self. But it led me to realize just how thoroughly relational myself was, that I was literally dependent on others to come back to life, and very fortunate in that I encountered many others who helped me to do that. What I said earlier about wanting to have a baby, the lag of 2.5 years before we were able to start trying again, had more to do with my reluctance to bring into this horrible, unpredictable world a new human being I couldn't protect.
What changed? And how did it change?
With the help of lots of other individuals. Actually, there's one story I'd like to relate. A philosopher friend of mine, Eva Kate, had some years before introduced me to her mother, Sarah, who passed away a few years ago. She survived Auschwitz and went on to have a very rich, full life, and her wonderful daughter, Eva. And Eva just looked at me and she said, look what my mother went through. What are you talking about? Of course you should go and have a child. And I also felt, I think Bill talks about this in his book as well, there's a certain point where that I reached, where I could decide. I couldn't do anything about what happened to me or about the state of the world, but I could decide. Do I choose life and go forward, or do I finish this guy's job for him and miss out on the rest of life? And I chose life.
There's a certain quality in that interaction, Susan, and I want to pick it up, and Steve, I want you to comment on it also. She said to you, look at what my mother went through. And to me, that's more than advice. It's more even than a role model. It's compassion. It's more than just people. It's compassion. You were in the presence of another human being who gets it. And so it's we need other humans, whether they get it or not, to survive. But it's this business of compassion that is so difficult when we are traumatized, because the human instinct, I'm asking this of you, Steve, the human instinct in the face of what we have endured, the instinct is to turn your gaze away.
Oh, absolutely. And to go back into a shell or cave, not to feel perhaps that we have the capacity to be human ourselves. We've been, when those incidents occur to us, we've been dehumanized. And we lose those feelings. And we lose confidence that we can, in fact, now reach out and touch someone else in any particular way. So they're profound. It's a profound experience.
You know, the Greek roots of compassion, co-passion, it's having the courage, the wherewithal to try to experience what other experiences. And often we can get that with a nod of a head from a kindred spirit, from someone who has been there. But it's so important that everybody understand that that act of compassion, with words or without words, can really help save somebody's life.
This is a special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb at Penn Law School's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Coming up, we'll look at personal recovery and discuss the moral implications of combat. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, taped before a live audience at Fitz Auditorium, hosted by the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. I'm Larry Roebling. Today, Bill Edmonds, a lieutenant colonel in the Army Special Forces, explains how his role witnessing interrogation and torture left him with invisible wounds. Dr. Steven Zanekis, a retired Brigadier General and Army Medical Corps officer, asks if we can really prepare ourselves for trauma. And Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth College, gives us a wrenching account of the aftermath of sexual assault.
I want to address one item that really needs to be talked about, Bill and Susan, and that's what happened when you came home, and just give us a brief overview of what happened. Susan, you, in the weeks, months, maybe even year after this
I spent
happened.
11 days in the hospital in Grenoble. I got two cards from my mother while I was in the hospital, and one of them said, had on the front, "Isn't the sun nice? Isn't the wind nice?" And then you open it up and said, "Isn't everything nice? Love, Mom." I mean, the cognitive dissonance. The other one was about, "I'm sending the bluebird of happiness your way to ensure you have a lovely day," or something like that. And 3 months later, when I hadn't heard from any of my relatives, these are very loving people, but I was angry that this had happened to me. And I was angry at the emotional illiteracy of many around me. And this was 26 years ago. It was not polite to talk about having been raped, let alone to talk about having been raped and nearly murdered. And I was just stunned that none of my relatives, who would have sent cards and bouquets if I'd had an appendectomy, said a word. And when I mentioned this to my mother, she said, "Oh, oh, they're all terribly afraid of reminding you of what happened.
Had you forgotten?
No, I had not forgotten. You know, by that time, 3 months, maybe I thought about it only once every 5 or 10 minutes rather than constantly, but even a year or two after, I felt really lucky if I could go for an hour without thinking about it. I mean, now I can go for days, but I want to also mention the response in France. My assailant was apprehended about a day later. There was plenty of physical evidence. The trial was 2.5 years after the assault, and that was a moment of release for me. I think that's why it was possible to think about having a child. Mm. And I did. I shouldn't keep you in suspense. I have a wonderful son who's 22 years old and is the joy of my life. But right before the trial, I met with the Attorney General in Grenoble and went over the case. And I was leaving his office. He looked at me and he said, after the trial is over, you must forget that this ever happened. You know, that's going to be rather difficult for me to do. And he fixed his gaze on me and said sternly, but Madame, you must make an effort. And that was a transformative moment for me. It was, for him, it was as if I was the only woman that this had ever happened to. And if I could just forget it, it would never happen to anybody else again. Whereas I viewed what had happened to me as a gender-based crime that had everything to do with how boys and girls are socialized and how men and women are in our society. And by that time, 2.5 years later, I'd gotten to know lots and lots of other rape victims, most of them women. So for somebody to say to me, especially someone in the criminal justice system, after the trial, you must forget that this ever happened, gave me the determination to be very public about it.
Well, you know, as a clinician, I know that when we give people unsolicited advice, we're inevitably talking to ourselves. Bill, could you give us, just briefly tell us what happened to you in the wake of your coming back?
So I came home, no visible wounds, but something had changed inside, but I just didn't know it at the time. So, you know, I locked those memories away and focused my energies on starting a new life. A new job, a wife, and starting a family. But memories from war never just fade away. They can seep and reach through time with searching and grasping claws. And 5 years after leaving Iraq, my past had finally caught up with my present. So finally, desperate, with an inch of my life, I reached out for help to both the mental health profession and the military, and they rolled their eyes. And lots has changed. But back then, the counselor, after about 70 minutes of me talking, said, you don't fit the profile of PTSD. So, you know, there is nothing wrong with you. You just don't know how to handle stress. And later, my military supervisor said that I was, you know, thought me a malingering drama queen and a security risk and weak. So they did both provide some helpful parting advice. The counselor said that I should continue my writing, that writing couldn't hurt and might do some good. Every morning I woke up early to relive again and again and again through the written word, every thought, every word, and every choice. Writing was like a personal form of immersion therapy. It was therapeutic, but it was also traumatic. But it gave me the space to breathe, to slowly process my experiences, to practice what Nancy Roberts called imaginative self-empathy. And I was able to do this because I fortunately found myself inside a safe, non-judgmental, an empathetic community.
Steve, I'd like you to come back and weigh in on the difference between military sexual trauma. How are they dissimilar? What do they have in common?
There are common elements to almost all traumatic experiences. Feelings of helplessness, feelings of shock, And at the moment, or during the, as the experience unfolds, the various reactions we have psychologically and physiologically. We protect ourselves with an adrenaline response, a fight or flight reaction. So there's some commonalities here. There are also distinctions. The most important is appreciating that, in fact, each individual's experience is distinct. We lose that in our profession because we are now in an environment that emphasizes protocols and outcomes and diagnostic criteria and so-called objective information and data points so that we can make decisions about what treatments we're going to pay for and how long we're going to pay for them. There are all these overriding factors that really influence the basis of much of what we do in our profession. This is the most human of experiences. When a person is traumatized and being able to grasp that feeling and feel confident that they can share it with someone else is very individual. I find that in my exposure as a physician and as a soldier, that men or women who have been sexually traumatized, and that is for them the primary event that they think about when they think about their trauma, do in fact consider it or try to understand it. It's different than a soldier who has been in the battlefield for a year and come back and been back for another year. There are cumulative experiences that come into combat. I've also had the opportunity to work with victims of torture, some people that are notorious, actually, victims of torture. They've been subjected to trauma for years at a time, and their experience is different. So there are clear differences, I feel, of a sexual traumatic event and a person who's been in combat, torture, or a person who's had been the victim of an earthquake or another natural disaster. And there are some commonalities.
So what I'm hearing you say is that when we treat people who have experienced trauma, the first thing we have to do is treat people who Absolutely. Have experienced trauma. And that one person's gold standard might be another person's fool's gold.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes it more complex and more humane at the same time. I'm afraid we're losing that a little bit in our field, and I know you have the same concerns. So, Susan, you said in your writings that rape is not considered a philosophical subject, but war is. What do you mean?
Well, I'm happy to say that in the last 22 years, that has changed. And there are anthologies about rape written by philosophers. It's different now. But at the time, I mean, just war theory was an appropriate thing for philosophers to write about. Rape was not, and that was partly, I'd say largely, a matter of demographics. There were very few women in the profession. There still aren't that many. It's called the humanities exception. There are not many women who stay in the profession of philosophy. But even what was written about war back then wasn't written from the perspective of the warriors, you know, or victims. It was all very abstract and theoretical. Under what circumstances is it just to do what? And so there was a real disdain for narrative, for people telling their stories. Right? Philosophers are supposed to give arguments, you know, give the premises and then the conclusion and show that it's valid. You know, narratives are for literature, and that's soft stuff. And I was actually very inspired by some legal theorists, critical race theorists, including Patricia Williams, who wrote first-person narratives about what it was like to be the victim of racism in the U.S. And I learned a great deal from that. And I thought it would be useful for me to try to integrate narrative into my philosophy. And I should say that I didn't write Aftermath as therapy. I had a lot of therapy. And I did therapeutic writing for myself. But my main purpose in writing that book was to show philosophers that they had something to learn from trauma survivors, and also to raise awareness about gender-based violence.
I'm curious about this business of military PTSD, Steve and Bill. What happens in boot camp? Is there anything that goes on in boot camp that takes PTSD risk into account? I also wonder if there's anything that goes on that mitigates risk for PTSD.
For thousands of years, we have taken young men mostly, and now young women, and brought them into the military. There are some practices as we do that that have really stood the test of time. Inherent in that training is preparing that individual to in some way depersonalize or dehumanize their target and their enemy. We think about it, and it's, of course, very shocking, right? Something we don't want to do in our everyday life. On the other hand, we're now asking people to commit one of the most horrendous acts that they can. We're legitimizing it. We're saying you can go out and kill because you have an overriding purpose, and your tribe or your country or your community tells you that it's the right thing to do, but it's still a real horrible act to commit.
Anything that's being done to help them?
There are a number of things that we're looking at, all sorts of different training within the military. The fact is that we take 18, 19, and 20-year-olds into the military. They're a very dynamic time in their lives. There are a lot of things going on and changes, and we really don't know what's going to happen at 25, even if we do give them some really top-flight training. So there are those things that we need to do, and to recognize that some of these things are just unavoidable. When something really bad happens, no matter how much training, no matter how much preparation, it is so shocking, it is so frightening, that the aftermath of it is unavoidable. We need to have people there to reach out and touch them.
You've said it beautifully. It's finding our voice, finding our way, finding what heals us, hopefully, in the presence of person or people who care and understand.
This is a special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, tackling our response to trauma, both in civilian and military life. Coming up next, our audience reflects on violence, combat, and the moral scars of trauma. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. He's been talking about trauma with Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth College, Bill Edmonds, lieutenant colonel in the Army Special Forces, and Dr. Stephen Zinnekis, retired brigadier general and Army Medical Corps officer. Now it's time to hear from our live audience. What is their response to trauma and the moral issues it raises?
For anybody who's got comments or questions, we've got a couple of microphones and a couple of able volunteers.
It just struck me that there is a contradiction that I would like you to comment on. In preparing people for combat, to try to prevent them from having PTSD, are we teaching them more about this dehumanization? And is that preventing them from having the moral injury that happens because you're doing something you might not supposed to be doing? And the second point related to that is that, what is the difference between preparing them for that comeback and those who are actually terrorizing us now? Because they are also being prepared by some people for their combat, and they are preparing them by actually teaching them to dehumanize and objectivize the other people.
Great question. Steve, let's start with you.
This is where leadership and the community, the military community, or the unit comes into play. We prepare people, we train our soldiers to depersonalize and dehumanize. Otherwise, it'd be very, almost impossible to, unless they're flat-out psychopaths, to commit these horrendous acts. Having done that, in the midst with a confusion that, and the shock of after a firefight, it has been important over centuries to recognize that the unit around them, and particularly the sergeants and the first sergeants, who were like in the old days, like the father figures, were there for essentially a debriefing to make sense of what happened, to allow the people to process those events. And it's my own personal worry that we lose a lot of that in the modern military. We have sanitized much of warfare. We've distanced in a way. And the fact that it is an intimately deep experience has fallen through, I think, has dissipated. And that is what is the safety net that can be done in good combat units. That's what good commanders do, and good sergeants and squad leaders.
Let's turn to our next question.
I think there are two large differences between the current state of how war is fought. There are still many troops that are fighting in person. There's also a move to have unmanned missions and unmanned drones and things like that as part of war, and that there's also less of a shared community because of a volunteer army, that there isn't as much of a shared experience among people as there might have been during the Vietnam era when there was the draft.
Bill?
I don't think proximity is a metric for the degree of trauma. Pushing a knife into someone's chest could have the same impact as the flyer who's in Nevada pushing the button and seeing the screen get closer and closer. That's what I believe.
Just to add to that, I've heard some critics of drone warfare say, well, it's going to make the soldiers impervious to the fact they're harming other people. From what I've read, I think for many of them, it's the opposite. You know, they watch their targets for days and days. They see them take their kids to school, right? Even though they're on a different continent, I think they have this proximity that puts them at even greater risk of moral injury. Mm.
I think it's important to note that the greater the disconnect between the citizen and the service member, the less impact that war has on the civilian, the more likelihood that war will be perpetual, because it's easy and then easily forgotten.
Thank you, Bill.
First, I just wanted to say thank you for speaking with us. As a survivor of many years of childhood sexual abuse, it's very empowering to see you up here speaking, and it resonates within me, and I appreciate that, so thank you. With that being said, I'm curious, in the current culture shift, the use of the words trigger warning for people with PTSD, identifying your triggers is a big feat. And I feel that there's a flippant use of the word trigger warning in our society, in our culture today. Mm-hmm. Is that good or bad? I feel like it doesn't give enough credibility to us that we use that.
Thank you for that, and I'm so glad that you've survived and that you are here today with us, having experienced what I experienced once at age 35. I have no idea how people like you survive that kind of abuse, and it's heartening to see you. I'm also heartened that we're now, as a society, able to talk about rape, that we're able to talk about the real harms, including moral harms of war. We weren't really 25 years ago. What that means is we're going to be saying things that are going to be potentially disturbing to people. And if I include a section on rape in a course that I'm teaching, I do give students, I don't call it a trigger warning because that term has so many different meanings to different people, but a content advisory. It's just common sense. I think I read something yesterday. I now forget who wrote it. But, you know, if you invite someone over to your house to see, you know, a lighthearted comedy, and then you show them a snuff film, you know, this is just not okay. I mean, I think people should have some knowledge of what's going to come next, and especially in the classroom. I think when students are choosing classes, they should know what to expect. But at the same time, I think that what disturbed me most 26 years ago was not that people were talking about this, or I might be in a conversation or a class when somebody would talk about rape, but that nobody talked about it. Right? That was a trigger for me.
Thank you for that teaching, Professor. It's very valuable.
One of the things that I took away is our capacity to dehumanize each other. Because all three of you explained in one way or another how you reacted to someone's ability to dehumanize you.
As long as you are asking us to fight on your behalf, you need to expect us to dehumanize our enemies. You cannot expect us to do any different. All right? You need to take responsibility for your choices as citizens.
I find myself in the same ethical, moral quandary, anxiety, and state of tension today as a retired general, as I did as a cadet and as a captain and as a colonel, and when I asked my soldiers to go to war and was preparing myself to go to war. I don't know if any of that I was doing at that time seemed right, and I can't say today that I know if any of that seemed right. I'd prefer that we didn't have wars. I prefer that we didn't dehumanize and depersonalize, that we would commit such violence against each other's and our communities and our families. But I also am totally confounded, but appreciate that there is evil out there, that there are people out there that want to do things and hurt my family and hurt me in ways that I would never, ever be able to commit. And we've got to be able to do something about that. I don't think there's any resolution. I think it is what defines us and defines our human experience. And people make tough decisions. And they make wrong decisions. And I have made plenty of wrong decisions and plenty of decisions I regret. And I ask my family, and I ask my loved ones, I ask my community, I ask you all to forgive those mistakes. That's what I think needs to be done in a public way and in a private way.
Susan?
I used to think I was a pacifist. I mean, in some sense, I suppose I still am, but my experience taught me that I am capable of killing someone in self-defense or in defense of my family. And that was, I think, an appropriate realization. At first, I thought it was a moral loss. But then I thought, no, I'm entitled to do that. At the same time, I think those of us who have been victimized, whether we're individuals or countries, have to be very cognizant about what we do in response. Because there could be this just perpetual acting out of the trauma and inflicting it on other people. This does happen. Alternatively, as individuals or as countries, we can work through it and try to make sure that we aren't like the people who victimized us. I was shocked when someone who knew that I had always been against the death penalty, after learning of what happened to me, said, "Well, so now are you in favor of the death penalty?" And I said, "No, I am more opposed to it than I ever was, because I have looked into the face of some human being who was trying to kill me, who was capable of killing another human being, and I don't want that to be the face I see when I look in the mirror."
Thank you very much for your thoughts today. I'm from South Africa, so that's the accent. So I wonder if I could just ask a question on a slightly more macro level. But it seems to me that we have never really found a way to deal with national systemic traumas that truly heals the wounds of the past to move to sort of a unified future. If you look at Nuremberg trials in South Africa, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and kind of neither retribution nor a reconciliation sort of rhetoric has led towards unifying the oppressor and the oppressed. And I was wondering whether any of you have any views on how to deal with the national psyche after a systemic or large-scale trauma.
You should come to more of the seminars sponsored by the Center for Ethics and Rule of Law. That's the big question. And how that continues to disrupt our world and the peace, and what are the mechanisms available to us as individuals, as governments, as responsible citizens to achieve those goals and objectives that are so laudable for healing and to bring that kind of peace and to be able to reconcile those tensions that exist in various parts of the world and across these various cultural and ethnic groups. I don't think perhaps what we have said here today is an element of that. And there's an essence in the human experience and understanding that for those people who share in the Abrahamic faiths, that we all are made in the image of God and that we all share some fundamental elements of our soul that to be shared, and that we need to take those and put them into policy, into practice. And to disavow that language and to disavow those policies that are of hatred and antipathy and vengeance and vindictiveness, and that there are more enlightened ways to achieve and at least in some way go forward so that we can do what you've laid out here. But that requires each of us to act responsibly, both as individuals and in our positions of leadership.
Let me press you on this.
Sure.
You said it requires each of us to go out and act. We've got an audience here. We're going to have an audience listening to the show. Give us our marching orders tomorrow morning. What can we do? What should we do?
I think we've got to be aware of what we do that in fact is, we all have the capability to hurt someone. We all have the capability to traumatize. We all have the capability to bring sadness into someone's life. And it starts in our homes, in our families, in our close relationships. And it starts in our work environment to be as aware about it as we can, to exercise humility about everything that we do, and to take a moment, take a deep breath, and say, "I'm not going to give in to that." That is step one, I believe, when we wake up. And then it goes from there. As a doctor, as a psychologist, as a general, as an infantryman, as a professor. But you live it out every day in your life.
Thank you so, so much to all three of you for the work you do. Thank you deeply.
Thanks. Thank you, Dan.
This has been a Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guests, Susan Bryson, professor of philosophy at Dartmouth College and author of Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self. Bill Edmonds is a lieutenant colonel in the Army Special Forces and the author of God Is Not Here, Torture, Trauma, and the Moral Injuries of War. And Dr. Steven Sinekis is a retired Brigadier General, an Army Medical Corps officer, and has been a senior advisor to the Department of Defense on neurobehavioral conditions. Many thanks to Penn Law's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law and Professor Claire Finkelstein for hosting this discussion. Find a link on our website. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. We'd love to hear from you. The engineers for today's show were Adam Stanishevsky and Diana Martinez. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of WHYY Audio Content. Mike and Scott is Voices executive producer. I'm Larry Roebling, writer and producer of WHYY's Voices in the Family. Dr. Dan Gottlieb is the host.
Have a good week, my friends. And the week after that. And the week after that. And the week after that.